Maybe you saw the new Blade Runner last month, full of replicants, robotically engineered human beings. Science fiction, obviously, but it may not be that far into the future. A new book is called Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human, and it looks at how scientists are learning to create bionic human body parts. And with me is the author, Adam Piore. Hello there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
This is a pretty optimistic book, I gotta say. You're talking about, you use storytelling about people who have actually, in one way or another, replaced a body part, usually because there was an accident or something needed to occur. So let's start with the person you start with, which is Hugh Hare. He lost both his legs to frostbite while he was mountain climbing. Here's a little bit of his voice.
I began by developing specialized limbs that allowed me to return to the vertical world of rock and ice climbing. I quickly realized that the artificial part of my body is malleable, able to take on any form, any function, a blank slate for which to create perhaps structures that could extend beyond biological capability.
Are you making the case that his new limbs that he designed himself are better than his original limbs?
Oh, no, definitely not. But, you know, it's just a great story, Hugh Hare. It's a great story of resilience and optimism. But, you know, what he actually did is he was a champion rock climber and about a C and a D student in school. When he lost his limbs, he wandered into the wilderness and got frostbite, and both his limbs were amputated. And the doctors told him he'd never run or walk again or climb.
Or climb, yeah.
But what he did is he got on the climbing wall, and he was actually lighter than he had been before because he was missing his limbs. And he started messing with his prosthetics. So he made his prosthetics better for climbing, you know, because he could make them any shape he wanted. So he made them, you know, 7 feet long so he could reach holds. He made them 2 feet short with little blades that could go into crevices. And he could, you know, soon he was a better climber than ever before. And he, you know, was a subject of fascination. He was on 60 Minutes. He was on the cover of Outside Magazine and all these things and was world famous. He was already a great climber. But what happened is when he would come off the wall, he would realize that he would be profoundly disabled. And he was walking on these limb, you know, these basically a peg leg, which hadn't changed in a couple hundred years. And it was, you know, chafing his skin and giving him, you know, making him miserable. So he started tinkering with that. And he came with his prostheticist. He came up with a kind of a cushion and got a patent, but he also started taking classes and discovered an interest, a reason to pay attention in engineering. And he became a straight A student. And then he got into MIT. And now he's a leading prosthetics engineer. Now, I don't think his limbs yet are better than the real thing because we haven't yet connected them to the nervous system. So you can't move them just by thinking. You kind of have to push on them. But it's remarkable what he was able to accomplish. And really, I sort of fell into this rabbit hole of this over the last 10 years through this story. I mean, it's an incredible story of human resilience. He used to wake up in the morning and he'd be dreaming about running through the field behind his parents' house with the wind blowing in his hair. And then he'd wake up to the stumps of his legs and start crying. His doctors told him he'd never run again. Now he jogs every day. But what this is an example of is we now have the sensing and computational power to figure out how the constituent parts of the leg move and work together to create movement. And he's actually made robotic parts that emulate what they do.
So this is all part of bioengineering. What is included in bioengineering? I mean, if you get a knee replacement, is that bioengineering?
It depends, but yeah, I think so. It's basically engineers are turning their sights inward, right? In the last century, we sent people to the moon. We built new kinds of vehicles. We built skyscrapers. Now we sort of have the resolution to look inward and to decode how the constituent parts of the body move and work together and to build replacement parts and to sort of hack the system. So that's what I was looking at. I mean, it's not all bioengineering in here, but a lot of it is. It's basically engineering biology. So I looked at regenerative medicine, where we're figuring out how stem cells work, how they respond to their environment, and how we can, you know, try and regrow parts of the body that have been lost, you know, muscle, bone, people are trying to regrow limbs. That's going to be a while. We're talking about genetic engineering, which is
messing with the DNA code,
right? And brain-computer interfaces. You know, all sorts of things. It all has to do with just decoding the way the body works and finding ways to fix broken parts and possibly upgrade it.
And one of the things that you discuss in the book is the ethics of augmentation. What kind of work is being done on finding that line, that ethical line?
Well, let's see. What is being done? I mean, there's a lot of talk.
Right, exactly. But it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of... It sounds like each person is sort of making that up as for themselves.
Well, I mean, you know, we're not there yet. I mean, the most controversial part is genetic engineering, right? That's what I think we have to worry about. And, you know, we're just beginning. We have, you know, however many nucleotides, I forget, 2 or 3 billion nucleotides. We don't have the computational power to understand how they all work together, most of these traits, and how they interact with the environment for most of the things that make us who we are, right? And, you know, some of the first genetic engineering therapies have been approved in the last couple of years, but they're for very basic things, one gene diseases. And what I found is that a lot of the stories that I wrote, I mean, I went in thinking this could be dystopian, this could be scary, but what I found is what's driving a lot of this research is the desire to help people who've lost things. And that's really where it's making an impact. I didn't see any examples of abuse of this yet. You know, it's all about people who, like Hugh Herr, who couldn't walk and couldn't run and now can run again. There's a woman in there with an incredible story who can see with her ears. And she was able to gaze upon a mountaintop and started crying again, you know, crying because she was so happy. And you know, there's a local guy here who was locked in and, you know, he was trying to be able to communicate with his kids. And so that's what's really driving the money for this. Sure, there's plenty of ethical considerations that are going to come up, and we'll deal with them as they come up. Some of these things have been derailed in the past. I have a chapter on deep brain stimulation, and that is being used to treat people with Parkinson's, but also with depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And they're looking at ways to treat other things. And in fact, there's a famous local person named Helen Mayberg at Emory who does research on deep brain stimulation and depression. But a lot of experimenting with electrodes in people's brains was derailed for a while because it was so controversial and because there were abuses in the 70s and 80s. A much more crude way of interacting, but there was congressional hearings and it sort of fell out of favor, and so people are very careful now.
There is, though, I mean, you spoke earlier about the fact that we haven't quite been able to connect these artificial limbs to the nervous system. But we have started to be able to see advances in, say, the human brain, a human being able to control a computer with their mind. How long do you think we get before those two sort of technologies merge and we're able to use the mind to control a limb?
Well, actually, we have been able to do that in the lab. There's a locked-in woman, a quadriplegic woman who was able to control a robotic arm and actually use it to eat chocolate. And she was able to high-five her, you know,
so
her doctors.
So the important stuff first.
Yeah. but as somebody said to me, he said, until you could drive a wheelchair safely in traffic using your mind or on the edge of a cliff, it's not going to come out of the lab. And the fact is that you could control movement of a wheelchair if you're locked in with your eyes or with a joystick much more... you won't want to get invasive brain surgery when you can use a joystick to move something. You know what I mean? So until it increases, until we find less invasive ways, but also until the resolution and accuracy of these things increase, they're going to stay in the lab. But we are pushing that. And now there's a guy at University of Pittsburgh named Andy Schwartz, he's the one who worked with this woman who was able to feed herself chocolate with a robotic arm, and he's now working on the sensory cortex, which is sending signals back the other way so that, you know, the robotic arm, you can have a sense of touch.
Can touch something and know
if it's hot. Yeah. So they're doing this. It's sort of like, you know, the initial IBM computers or something. You know, these are prototypes that aren't commercial yet, But I mean, our understanding is improving in leaps and bounds. It's pretty astounding, and you know, that's what this book is about.
And you do a good job of having real life examples of people for most of the science that you're talking about. This is Adam Piore, author of the new book Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. He appears for a book signing at the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta today at noon. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.